You're listening to Architecture Masters.
Somebody asked me where it began, and I did say, you know, I think about the age of five, I discovered myself on a hotel corridor looking at a sunrise over the Acropolis. I am told I rushed back in a fever with this incredible vision. And I think I decided that I was going to pursue architecture at about the age of 15. And my parents were good enough then to go down to Rome. And I took a suitcase with some charcoal and a lot of sketching paper. And I drew my way around Rome. And I decided at that point that that's what I want to study.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. With me, Owen Wainhouse.
So I'm Eric Parry. I'm the principal of Eric Parry Architects, and we've been going for around about three decades.
On the programme this week is the architect Eric Parry. Eric was born in Kuwait in 1952, where his father was chief medical officer, helping the country establish its health service. When Eric was 10, the family returned to the UK and settled in Liverpool. Eric later studied architecture at Newcastle University in the early 1970s, before going on to spend a year in Iran studying nomadic settlement. Returning again to the UK, Eric studied at Hornsey College of Art, before going on to study at the RCA, where he gained his MA, and then at the Architectural Association in London. Eric began his professional career as a lecturer at Cambridge University, where he taught for 14 years. Alongside his teaching, in 1983, Eric founded Eric Parry Architects. In 1997, he made a decision to focus principally on the business, which is now a 90-person strong practice, based just off Old Street in East London. The practice has developed a huge body of critically acclaimed work, especially in the cultural and conservation sectors, and mainly in London. In this week's episode, we talk about Eric's early influences in Athens and Rome, as well as his interest in nomadic settlements. We talk about his work teaching and the move from academia into practice. And we touch on some of the practice's most notable projects, including the renovation or renewal of St Martin in the Fields Church just off Trafalgar Square, as well as Pembroke College in Cambridge and One Eagle Place just off Piccadilly. And finally, we hear about the practice's recent plans for Number 1 Undershaft, which is set to become one of the tallest buildings in the City of London. I joined Eric in his offices, where I started by asking about those early influences in Kuwait.
Jumping maybe right back, you were born in Kuwait. So your parents, neither of them were architects?
No, there were absolutely no architects in my family whatsoever. But, my father was called to work for the ruler of Kuwait in 1948 to set up a health service.
Right.
My mother's a nurse.
Okay.
And that was very important in order to draw the Bedouin into... And there were a lot of tropical diseases that were prevalent. So my parents had been in India before and during the Second World War. Right. And therefore, in fact, I was a post-war mistake. But I grew up then in really a very biblical setting of dhows being built. Anyway.
I mean, hugely different city, Kuwait.
It was a walled city.
Yeah.
Built of dried mud, and where every room was determined by the width of a dhow, because that's the way the roofing, flat roofing timbers arrived,
right.
And so on. So completely different and very dependent on passive environmental control. So I watched the transformation and the establishment, amongst other things, of hospitals being built in the desert. And I therefore, because there weren't hotels at that point, The architects responsible for these new buildings often stayed. And I guess I was kind of, that was one element that I could see this metamorphosis, probably. This is post-rationalizing. And the other thing I think which was extraordinary was coming back to this country, which meant a first stop in Beirut and then a second stop in either Rome or Athens. And so I saw as a kid not only the desert, but I saw these amazing artifacts of ancient culture. And undoubtedly, that's kind of switched me on. So that's where it began. Thereafter, it's as much to do with what I thought I could achieve or manage, you know, in a civilized way. As you say, it's often very long hours, but it's incredibly rewarding, I think, anyone involved in the business of architecture and building and making has to see that there is amazing satisfaction in that process, which marks it out from, for instance, the lawyer's fate, whose eloquence will, you know, arrive in the skip, you know, 7 years later, you know, and so each profession has its fantastic creative sides. But I think this business of is both harrowing and kind of worrying. I think it's a very hugely responsible position, which shouldn't be overbearing, because otherwise the result is always going to be mediocre. But there is that sort of sense that a building lasts, and others are going to have to both pass it or work in it, or whatever, for a great length of time.
So early schooling in Kuwait. Were there international schools in Kuwait?
They were, but it was pretty mixed, you know, as a primary school, primary education, and a great number of Arabs and Palestinians, particularly, and others. So, you know, you can imagine, this was very much closer to the city. There were ghettos, particularly for oil.
Right.
Those involved in the oil industry, but happily that wasn't my situation.
You were living
right in the middle of the old town,
Okay. And then age 10, you moved. I mean, you say moved back to the UK. You were moving to the UK for the first.
Well, my first time. From the age of 8, I then got dropped into this country.
Okay.
So. Backwards and forwards until 10, then my parents had left,
And that was to London? Where did you...
No, to Liverpool, actually.
Right.
And and that's where my parents had met. So my mother was from Scottish roots, my father from Welsh roots. So Liverpool is a kind of... Yeah, very
meeting
strong
point.
Celtic.
Okay.
Yeah, meeting point, exactly. So so Liverpool was a very different place, I think, to the one they remembered leaving in sort of 1934.
And then studies in study art.
It's very interesting, I suppose, to some anyway. I decided I had either a place at the AA or a place at Newcastle, and I decided that actually I would go to Newcastle. An interesting time in the AA's history. I think I had my interview on the day that the huge debate about whether to join Imperial College was happening. So it was it was an incredible scene.
Yeah.
And much as I kind of found it extraordinary, I felt actually perhaps that through the interview and what was an offer at Newcastle was equal. And I was right, I think. It was an amazing introduction to landscape. But right next to the architecture department was the art department, and a really good art department. And it was very strong, the thinking, the art and architecture world within Newcastle was also mixed with a good dose of reality and social sciences. Mm. Sociology was very strong. So Actually, I came out of the third year at the end of that, and worked for a housing association architect for a year, and actually established a housing association in Benwell, which is in a really downtrodden part of the world. It's now being completely erased and rebuilt, and has nothing of its old character, leading down to the Tyne.
Right.
And the Armstrong Works, you know, these amazing step terraces. But I left having erected a Turkoman tent for somebody who asked for some help in the museum and the Lane Art Gallery, and been so mesmerized by it that it actually evoked very strong memories of my own childhood with right. the black tents and the Bedouin. Yeah. And I then went off to study a nomadic settlement in Iran for a year,
right.
Working with the anthropology department of Shiraz University, and wow. Traveling to India, where I met a number of amazing people, not looking actually for great architecture, but looking at housing and low-cost housing. So... that probably that moment in India, meeting a man called Kirti Shah and Doshi, of course, who I visited, I realized actually that the skills one needed for the train of thought that I was involved in would need the skills actually of a bank manager more than an architect. It was actually the funding of a cycle to get transportation from a place of living to a place of mercantile exchange that was the most important thing. And I realized that wasn't quite my gift. And on my routes, I had come across, and looking at the Qashqai tribe, I was completely besotted by the world of textiles. I met a textile designer who'd come newly emerged, as it were, from the Royal College of Art.
Yeah.
And I hightailed it back to London and decided to follow that other instinct that I'd been very aware of in Newcastle, of art. So I went to Hornsey and did a foundation year.
Right.
And
After coming back.
Okay. And from there, got a place at the Royal College of Art, where Ken Frampton... Right. John Miller, Sue Rogers, Ed Jones, yeah. and others were teaching a phenomenal course called Environmental Design.
Right.
There was also an Environmental Media course, which we didn't know each other then, but Richard Deacon used to go
right.
to. So we used to kind of go up the stairs or the lift in the same yeah. divide, left and right. But that was amazing. I still have my notebooks from a set of 2-hour long lectures that Ken Frampton gave on the European city,
right.
which for me were a fantastic foundation. And it was an extremely interesting course, but only of 12 in a year, believe it or not. So spread over 2 and 3 years, a mix of interior designers
yeah.
and architects, no RIBA accreditation,
right.
so completely outside that. And by that time, I'd kind of run out of my local authority funding, and there was a deal set up between John Miller, who was the professor at the Royal College, and Alvin, that I could attend the AA for a year to get my RIBA Part 2.
And we're talking, I mean, I guess it's, in hindsight, you know, did you know where you were going?
Yeah.
Wanting to set up a practice? Were you thinking about teaching? Or were you doing things for the enjoyment? I mean, what was the...
No, it was completely
a vision?
Completely. The vision, as I said, was very, very uncertain.
Right.
I was a night guard at the Serpentine Gallery for 5 years, not full time, but through the big
right.
shows. And I earned my money in an engineering practice at one point, and an architectural practice. But it was. There wasn't the necessity of, although I had a, you know, overdraft most of the time, there wasn't the necessity of paying back a huge loan.
Right, okay.
And living very much a very simple life. Yeah. You know, one could concentrate on doing odd things like, you know, helping Joseph Rickward to draw a competition, or certainly working with my own old tutor, Dalibor Vaisley, on various ideas. Okay. And then part-time teaching.
Yeah.
That was the safety net that allowed life to move on.
We've perhaps kind of slightly glossed over then this transition from moving back to the UK to when architecture became you talked about studying then in Newcastle. What was the drive that led you to study architecture?
I think it wasn't flippant, but somebody asked me where that it began, and I did say, you know, I think about the age of five, I discovered myself on a hotel corridor looking at a sunrise over the Acropolis. And I am told I rushed back in a fever with this incredible vision. And I think I was pretty certain. I decided that I was going to pursue architecture at about the age of 15.
Right.
And my parents were good enough then to drive in those days when you could only take £50 out of the bank each, per person, and to go down to Rome. And I took a suitcase with some charcoal and some a lot of sketching paper, and I drew my way around Rome.
Right.
And I decided at that point that that's what I want to study. Plus, actually discovering Pevsner, Outline of European Architecture, which I read voraciously, and invited him to come and speak at the school. And I still have the letter from him, politely declining because he was preparing for the Mellon lectures.
Right.
And, you know, out of that, those are like roots from which the trajectory is pretty never-ending, I think.
Yeah. So you started teaching and founded the practice. The practice sort of was on the side then, 83, you started.
I'd never, as I said, worked for a big architect, but there had been a single project partnership. I had a planning permission in my pocket when I left the AA.
Right.
And
what was that for? Do you remember?
A little sound recording. Actually, it's a sound recording desk manufacturing operation, I had discovered through doing some film sets at the National Film School. Okay. I discovered the people involved, or they'd asked me to get involved. So I suppose that meant that I'd built very young, actually.
Yeah.
I got my license, as it were, my part three, through that process, and then because I got my feet on the ground, I guess, I got an assistant lectureship at Cambridge in 1983, which was an amazing change for me because, you know, if I remember the tough staff meetings at the Polytechnic of Central London with the traffic and the, you know, and very interesting large school, engineering department, fantastic place. But if I contrast that with the staff meeting, the first staff meeting I went to in Cambridge, which a friend of mine, close friend of mine, rather cruelly described as like waking up in a drawer full of woolly socks. So amazing things happening, you know, all those Nobel Prize winners.
Yeah.
But still, the atmosphere of Cambridge is quite extraordinary. And I still remember the windows open at Pembroke College, actually, which became the site of one of the early projects, in a medieval room with tables covered with linen, and summer pudding, and in the background, so somewhere in the background, the sound of grass being cut, and this sort of heady combination of plotting the next year's studios with the smell of newly cut lawn and the stain of summer pudding. Just, you know, it's like some Dantesque sort of journey from, somewhere in the purgatorial world to its upper and lower reaches.
Wow. Okay. And so you were living in Cambridge at the time? You were.
Then, well, one of the questions at my interview was, would you live in Cambridge?
Right.
To which I pretty swiftly said yes, you know. I mean, that's what it was. But I was aware that the person who preceded me, Peter Blundell Jones, sadly, who died a couple of years ago, you know, had spent 5 years at Cambridge and then had been his tenure hadn't been granted. So I was in that view of a short term or medium term trajectory. And I thought that I really needed a safety net, mm-hmm. and that safety net should be practice. So I started above a garage, you know, in a room in a university flat.
Right.
That was 1983. So I established essentially the practice at the same time I got that teaching position.
Okay.
And then I did get tenure.
Yeah.
After some while. But at the point 14 years later, so we're talking 1997.
Yeah.
I really had to make a decision, unlike many of my contemporaries who do this fantastic thing, still of managing to teach and to practice. But teaching full-time at Cambridge with a lectureship was, I think, a bit different from running a studio in a school of architecture.
Yeah,
so it was rather full-on. I just, you know, with all the examinations, exam marking, lecturing, and so on, I really had to make a choice, and it was practices that I chose.
And what sort of size was the practice then when you left? How many of...
Well, it started, as I say, with a rotating pen and me, you know. Yeah. And by the time it got to 97, interestingly, at that point, Pembroke was built.
Right.
So that's a pretty substantial project. We were a practice of probably six.
Okay.
And... we had a tiny offshoot by fate rather than fortune hunting in Kuala Lumpur, which helped us survive, actually, because it was a very tough time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was very important, and that relationship has continued, actually. So the only other outpost, as it were, is a small office in Singapore at the moment.
The practice currently has, right.
Yeah.
Because a large...
Because we've always had a presence in that part of the world.
Right. But your huge bulk of your work is in London for choice, for,
probably for lack of, you know, getting a kind of lack of perception about the way the world was or might be, but it was initially to do with London because of the proximity to Cambridge and teaching.
Yeah, okay.
And slowly, it has sort of emerged that, particularly because of our ally, you know, the planning profession, that there is a very serious job to be done, and that requires trust. And actually, there's a certain sort of sense of
building that. Trust.
Well, and actually, as I intimated earlier, always innovation, but always learning what the world of difference was between, you know, a possible reality and a real possibility.
Yeah.
And treading
that
line. Say
that again, a possible reality and a real possibility.
Yeah. A possible reality being the stuff of the School of Architecture, real possibility being the dealing with somebody's money, for goodness sake, you know, many people's money, and of programs and of pragmatics and, you know, how to get things done. And that has always seemed to me a very particular difference between the mindset of an artist and an architect. Getting things done, of course, is absolutely vital for any artistic endeavor, but... it's a very different mindset.
Yeah, having the brief and having the... And you're, so now, 37th largest practice in the UK, the AJ 100 rankings, you know, big, big practice by... How many of you in the studio now?
Just under 90.
Right.
So it kind of ebbs and flows. And like I always described as like breathing, you know, ultimately we are, it's a cycle, it's what competitions you win or don't win. Yeah. And there's always this sort of sense of getting smaller or getting larger. But this is as large as it's been, and I very much think it's probably at a limit, which our space defines, by the way.
Yeah. I'm interested then in how you as a practice principal kind of adapts from that studio environment, you know, 20 people. Practice of 90 must be pretty hard to know, to keep a kind of kind of shared understanding really in the practice. That must be, it can't be something you're taught, you have to learn as you're doing, do you, as you grow the practice that way?
Well, I think actually the studios I ran, certainly when it was a year structure at Cambridge, would have been in the 30s, between 30 and 40.
Right.
Now, you had to know everyone's scheme.
Yeah.
From beginning to end.
Right.
And so, you know, I think like playing many games of chess at a sitting.
Yeah.
You know, actually I've got a kind of terrible memory, but you can ask me about a dimension on a student scheme, you know, 20 years ago, and I probably remember it. So there are certain things that one gets. Teaching for that number of years, you know precisely what the trajectory of each of the students is, and therefore the way in which a project is evolving. I would say there's something that that passes into practice in that sense of a sort of slightly autistic memory.
Mm.
And one has to then compile that with the added question of duration. So in practice, we've just finished a project in King's Cross, and I was doing the drawings for it in 2003. So that's 14 years.
Right.
So for probably 10 years of that period, well, one can be precise, 10 years of that period, it's been dormant.
Right.
Roger and Madeline would pass me and say, "Yeah, we're going to build your building. It's going to." I said, "Sure." 2 years later, the same thing happens. Some projects happen much more quickly, but let's face it: a project like making a movie probably is of a duration of 5 years or something, or a major novel. You know, they're big, long things. Now, people come and go in the process of that undertaking. But you have to know where it came from, know what the objectives were, know what it is you're trying to do, and so you know that's the kernel of it.
And then you sort of mentioned that perhaps kind of visual memory of architects. You're known, perhaps slightly unusually, kind of in the profession as a writer as well as an architect, and when we were talking earlier about writing in architecture and that form of communication, writing, I guess, is not always a strong point in architecture and in terms of architectural communication, in terms of how students talk about their buildings, often quite dense language. Just wondering, having taught for so...
Yeah, I was completely unprepared, actually, for the more formal aspects of academic teaching. Lecturing.
Right.
But I always remember Sandy Wilson, soon after I was appointed, announced that he was going on sabbatical and I was to give his first year theory lectures.
All right.
Which were very big shoes to step into.
Yeah.
And that business of then standing up in front of a year of, say, 40 eager, bright students who are going to write exams on what you provide them with, to questions you have to write, of course, you know, was an incredible baptism of fire, because I'd quietly, you know, set any and never had any ambition to write. But then had, as I say, a number of extraordinarily intelligent and articulate thinkers of architecture. Imagine those lectures of Ken Frampton's. Mm. Then imagine knowing Joseph, knowing Dalibor, knowing Peter Carl, many others. Your wits in terms of the perspective, I think, get sharpened a lot through those conversations. Mm. I never had any inkling that I could write. It was actually... ultimately, I had written a number of reviews, and I always remember being slightly perplexed when people would say, well, that's quite well written. And, you know, that was, to me, something, or, you know, there were interesting thoughts there. But actually, what I discovered was having the discipline of something, of a framework like that to write, gave me an extraordinary moment of revelation, in the sense that I discovered, I've talked about my bad memory, but actually having a framework to be thinking through meant that one was able to capture ideas, as it were, in a web that you create. And instead of them simply coming and going, yeah, one was able to marshal them in some way, and slowly, from a fog, a degree of clarity, you know, resolves. And so I had no idea, and I still don't. I mean, you know, and the other thing is discipline, because I would much prefer to be sitting on a drawing board.
Yeah.
Or observing, than I would writing.
I suppose, you know, all architecture is, to some degree, kind of problem solving. You know, in terms of projects. Might say, I mean, we talk about St. Martin in the Fields maybe as a kind of a conservation project, and I think you've said yourself that how much of that is architecture is kind of unseen, really, and you know, the problems you're trying to solve. You might say your architecture is quite, or certainly the project's quite cerebral, do you think? Do you think there's a lot of, come across as a, I mean, I guess that solid academic background kind of leads to, you know, a kind of degree of the kind of brain power that's gone into some of the projects kind of comes across. Do you think that's, they've been...
I never see myself as a sort of intellectual person either, actually, you know,
right.
I mean, this is my own perception. Mm. It's much more to do with a storehouse of thinking about scale and material and, you know, and challenging oneself constantly with what is the appropriate kind of framework for whatever it is you're designing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is that, I think, a kind of situational thinking that has been the most important thing. And actually seeing more things built gives you an intuition about how things come. So there's this deep-rooted kind of, after the number of iterations of doing things, there's a deep-rooted sort of sense of appropriateness to length and height and then sequence. Mm. Of spaces, you know, how one creates, you know, almost in a direct film directorial way, one thinks of, you know, I think, you know, I feel quite close to and having worked through film sets for some time, I feel quite close to that world of just thinking through a sequence of what it is one's trying to provide for a social condition. So that's the, on the one hand, you know, you're kind of threading, you're weaving things together in a spatial way. Sometimes it's very quiet, like the Charterhouse, where you almost want to be unseen at the end of it. Other times it's rather more explosive, like the Piccadilly building. Mm. But even there, there's a sort of thinking about street first, or block, urban block. Then King's Cross comes along and it's got to be a freestanding chess piece, which is great. I have no problem with that, the more sculptural kind of aspect of architecture.
Yeah. But a big theme through all of your projects is art and materials, really. That's, and we talked a little bit about where that might have come from as a concept, but just tell us a bit about where you think that...
Well, it's definitely... I mentioned, you know, the Kirchfitters and the Mertzbahn in Newcastle. Moving on from that, undoubtedly, having been a night guard at the Serpentine through a Henry Moore show... Seeing Henry Moore and David and Sylvester there.
As a night guard, literally a night guard.
A night guard, yeah, a night guard there. And two of us did it. Oh, and the other guy was called Parry as well. He was a painter. So it was Parry Inc. And we would only do it for the big shows that required. It was an arts council venue, so we had to ring into the Hayward Gallery every hour. But actually, I could have a drawing board there. And you were there before the show opened. So with the Henry Moores, they got unpacked. You were there. You were there when they were packed up 4 months later. Right. But I also did a Giacometti show. Wow. I did. I mean, I'm thinking of there were the painters, Howard Hodgkins, Richard Hamilton. There were also wonderful David Smith show of his work. There were also other shows that were very much part of my life there. So many others, Saul Steinberg, for instance, you know, fantastic figures. But the sculpture in the Serpentine from, you know, a Henry Moore maquette cabinet to these big pieces in the park, I think always played on me. And actually then working for a gallerist like Tim Taylor to meet people like Joel Shapiro. And for instance, and this had no part in her being chosen, but the East Window at St. Martin the Fields, there was an amazing art panel at St. Martin the Fields, chaired by Sir Nicholas Goodison. And, you know, there were many commissions, but the East Window is, of course, the most vital. Shiraze Hushiari, the artist, the listen artist, their brilliant artist, she was at Hornsey with me. Wow. We were both in a foundation year together. But then working with Tim Taylor, you know, I met a lot of his artists and came to respect a huge number of them. Yeah. And they always rubbed off in the projects, you know. Right. So the texture, the tactility of the work of particularly sculptors, you know, it's always on my mind. So when thinking about ceramic and Piccadilly, I wanted polychromy. I put forward a list to the Crown of artists I thought would win it. But actually, I was delighted when Richard Deacon did get it, because I had been completely awe-inspired by the visceral sort of glazes that he was achieving on his ceramic pieces.
And that's the building on just off Piccadilly. Yeah,
you know, but the point being that, you know, I can be talking, you might have said that I was, you know, very interested in stone at one point, absolutely right. And Stephen Cox remains a close friend from whom I've learned a huge amount about stone. But stone, sequence of stone, thinking about stone is in one set of projects, sequence thinking about ceramic in another, sequence of thinking about metal and glass in another. And rather like, you know, you work through a kind of material thematic as a sculptor, I think I do as an architect as well.
And do you, the kind of obvious thing to say is, you know, buildings are like sculptures, but do you sculpt your, I mean, what's interesting is you're in a sense commissioning artists as part of your projects. Mm. Do you do your own kind of sculptures, your own artistic sculptures? There's a, that I'm kind of interested in how you perhaps don't do sculptures yourself.
Yeah, no. Well, I think the answer is that when you're given a commission, you know, when it is a building, it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
That's where the idea of context becomes, to me, incredibly interesting. Because, you know, architecture is very different to sculpture or painting because, generally speaking, because it's absolutely of its place. It's not to say that it can't be a fabric or a temporary structure, but actually whatever a building takes its place in the city and there's a certain permanence. So you can say one thing about it. Every building is unique.
Yeah.
But every building is in dialogue. Generally, and even if it's with the sky, you know, but it is. And generally, it's the archetype of the street or the square that's completely, you know, is the ground, literally and metaphorically, from which it develops, in my mind. So I'm not going to say that a building should be sculptural. I'm going to look at the site and think about the site and think about the sort of the past in the present and the present in the future. And I'm going to respond in that way. So Piccadilly Circus is totally different to 8 St. James Square. that really is a stone's throw from each other. And it's for very good reason. You know, they culturally, they, you know, they're part of the City of Westminster, and a project in the City of Westminster is generally going to be very, very different from a project in King's Cross or certainly the City of London. But it's that issue of context that comes first. And, you know, it may be that it becomes more gestural. It may be that it becomes more viscerally sculptural. But I think architecture and this question of material is very important. It doesn't have to exhibit its structure, but I often think that given the way that materials are used, it is a useful ally. So to different degrees, however, having said that, you know, a building like King's Cross with its great big pieces of steel, clear construction, welding, you know, the people who seemed to be drawn to that were a bunch of sculptors, not fine artists, you know, at the kind of, we threw a party.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful array of sculptors and very few painters.
Right. I might just ask you to say a little bit about, St. Martin in the Fields is one of the, I guess, would you say, kind of pivotal points in the practice in terms of kind of big competition win? Was it? Tell us a little. I mean, so the competition, do you remember who ran the competition?
Yeah, it was a very interesting mix from the vicar, who's now the Bishop of Salisbury, Nick Holton, as then client representatives who weren't necessarily voting, I think. There were architects involved. There were Westminster, English Heritage. So you can imagine with a project like that, they'd started off and thought they might be able to build a building in the backyard, and it was clearly a disaster. So the question was how to tackle it.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, with all these things, you face them and it's another thing to do. So, you know, you go down for the site visit. And it was completely compelling because it was a chaos. And I knew that what had to be achieved, we just finished a spa at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel at Hyde Park, you know. And the question of how to maintain a sense of orientation in an underground space is really important. Actually goes back also to projects at the AA, cemetery project at the AA, just up the road, in fact. You know, all that experience over years and years it plays a part in the baggage you take. And I was told afterwards that, you know, when we walked around, I said to Nick Holden at some point, you know, this project is all about orientation and light.
Yeah.
And light understood, you know, as a iconology and not just as just pragmatics of getting light into space. So, you know, the proposal varied a little bit, but essentially it was there as an idea. And like any good competition, it seems to me there's a skeletal structure around which things can change and flex, but the idea is evident from that, and it is there through all the thick and thin of the process, which was extraordinarily complicated.
Right.
It was a very brave project. They went to site, they signed the building contract for £24 million, still with £12 million to raise. Now you imagine doing that after after the banking crash in 2007.
Yeah.
If it had happened at that point, never would have got off the ground. Right. But it happened in a sort of mood of optimism, kind of unflinching belief and optimism. Yeah. And did it. It's fantastic.
Wow. That's appropriate. Yeah. Appropriate, the belief for a church. And you're talking about designing a spa before, and then a historic conservation project, and then now on to I read somewhere Ministry of Sound somewhere in between.
Film
contrast
set
of,
well, it's just,
I suppose, the film set,
it's
maybe
what,
that's
it's what you
that's
can the, it's what you can what you can you what projects you can get. I mean, you know, one has to remember, it's just, No, but the Ministry of Sound, no, it was an extraordinary project, full of ironies and paradoxes and amazing extremes.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And actually, I was talking about the latter days of teaching with those full-scale artifacts, urban artifacts, and the bonquettes that we were designing in the Ministry of Sound, very much part of that. So, and it's at a certain point that you realize, well, you know, you're doing this in a studio at a small scale, but that is, this is real. This is what you're doing. You know, so the extension from teaching into practice at that point was seamless.
Right. Okay.
Through projects like the Ministry of Sound.
Yeah. And then talking about kind of extremes, moving on then to number one, Undershaft, you know, the tallest building in that cluster of a very well, you know, very high spec, very well designed neighbours and surroundings.
Mm.
That again, I mean, that's perhaps a change in direction, you know, big number of offices at Argent. I mean, you're talking about, so tell us about the...
Yeah, well, I think I don't know I don't know what the other competitors produced for it, but one part of being focused more in London than other places. London's quite complicated, particularly the city of London. Mm. It's full of weaves and alleys and small scale territories, all of which I know quite well because I had a child at the John Cass School on Aldgate, and travelling every day, more or less, from Golden Lane through the city, means you see all the warts and the problems and the kind of extraordinary eccentricities. And I travelled through that site for something like 7 years, right? So watching the beginning of the pinnacle start and then stop, and well beyond before that. So, and it at the same time, there's another competition on the other side of St. Helens, Bishopsgate, for the leather cellars, which we completed last year, which is, you know, a pretty monumental follow-on to St. Martin in the Fields, digging deep. And right next to a medieval wall, you know. So, and then we have, finishing the first quarter of next year, another stone's throw away from this, a project that started as a tower in conversation with Peter Rees, a tower and a plaza, actually, and then became an urban block building through our conversation. And I took as precedent, you know, some great urban block buildings in Europe. And so that is nearly built, but the deal was that we would get this new scale on Fenchurch Street, but we'd put a public park on top,
right?
A pocket park that anyone could get to, and that would connect to an alley that went through the building at ground level. And now, any client of yours is going to kind of say you're mad to think about that. And the agents were saying, you know, this is, you know, so I won't name them, but, you know, saying, no, that, you know, that now it's about to be a diktat of city buildings that they have public access to the top.
Yeah.
So it was at a very vital moment, you know, of achieving something, I think, very democratic, the pocket park, which kills two fundamental birds with one stone. The first is that you get public amenity, and so you build out the space, but you put public amenity back. And the second is that it strikes a mid-level in the City of London.
Yeah.
And that mid-level, if you look at it now, which I realized when we were building Aldermanbury, and you look down, it's a disaster zone. The roofscape, you know, it was at a time... Chimneys before the Clean Air Act, nobody could go there really, except those cast into that world of attics and so on. So then it changes, of course. Now it's all air conditioning plants,
yeah.
Why should that be? Yeah. And, you know, the taller buildings are looking down on this. So I believe this will be the first of a series of mid-rise buildings that have amenity on top. Now, sorry, that's a long discourse, but the point is that undershaft is very much part of that trajectory.
Right.
And it was absolutely obvious in looking at the competition that the public realm, and this, it's a big site, if you could minimize, relatively speaking, the footprint of the new building, you could open up the territory of the building to sunlight at that point, because it has a good south-facing aspect. Very important. Mm. You could create a public space in what is actually a very blocked space at the moment by lifting the building. So that meant pulling the core to one side. That meant that the structure had to have a lot of bracing because it's not a stem of a tree running up the middle. And ergo, you know, this sort of organization, which is quite pragmatic, coupled with the idea of contrast and achieving a building, a new building, a modern building that is not bottle green. And if you go to south of the river and look back,
yeah,
it is appalling that even the most sophisticated buildings are dark objects,
yeah, yeah,
as opposed to the beautiful cadaverous, but, you know, grey-white of Portland, yeah, stone. So yeah, this one is going to be white.
Right.
That's what it is. It's like the white pier at the center.
Yeah.
It has that. It has the slight entasis, which I believe renders it very proportionally beautiful in terms of its height, with the conceit that if you join the lines of the corners, they'll meet at 10 times its height at 3 kilometers.
Right.
But also, like the park on the top there, because of the daring of the scale of the building, which is quite accepted and is capped by the Civil Aviation Authority effectively, but that the top should not be a corporate manifesto. But that, having worked on the Charterhouse with the Museum of London, that it should be a place that two classes of school kids could get to at the same time.
Right.
And it would be the place from which, as the tallest building in the Eastern Cluster, it would be the place from which you could begin to understand the complexity of the city you live in or are visiting. So that's what it is. The top two floors are given to the museum to deal with.
And also, I guess, relatively new in the city, going down, you know, with kind of excavating a number of levels below ground for shops and for...
The area with the retail,
right,
and below that, the bicycles, the 1,600 bicycles, only six cars, is all within an existing basement.
Right, okay.
The new foundations for the tower will... Yeah. Penetrate that, but effectively we're taking a pre-existing
dig out
to make those levels.
Okay, but still providing some retail for the city, which is
very much in. I mean, and the other thing in my mind was looking at great precedents further than Europe was the Rockefeller Center. So I had written about that in context,
right. Yeah.
And spent a good amount of time kind of understanding it.
Right.
Yeah, and so there's a bit of that here.
And so the time scale for the project, when do you expect to...
It's a 10-year project. Okay. I hope it hasn't got the same kind of tap on the shoulder that the King's Cross had over a long period of time. But I suspect, you know, that cycles are what they are. Who knows what's around the corner? Yeah. But effectively, the City of London is the City of London. Mm. And I guess that, you know, if one looked ahead 10 years, it should be there. Yeah.
Planning is approved. It's gone through
planning. Planning is approved. Yeah, it has mayoral approval. Planning permissions only last a certain amount of time. Mm. So, you know, I would say hopefully in the next 5 years.
And we're not, I mean, maybe just starting to round off. I've taken a lot of your time already. You mentioned the mayor there, the mayor of London. I guess there's the the previous mayor's design advisory panel, a design advisory group, and now the mayor's design advocates. Just wondering really how much you've kind of, you know, engaged. Perhaps your name's not talked about in the same way as someone who engages in politics the same way as other architects of your fame might have done. Is that by choice? Is that through interest? Is that through interest in other things? Is it not?
Interesting question. I was a member of the, you know, the mayor's design advisory panel for many years.
Right. Okay,
but it didn't have the kind of traction it had earlier. Mm. You know, Boris Johnson was a rare visitor. Right. We did have those occasions. We did a lot of work, actually, and there's a lot of good work that came out of that. But I think having run through that for a number of years, I felt that actually there are certain things that I've done outside the practice, and a bit of writing, as you've said. Yeah. But that's lent heavily on experience from the practice. But I am a member of the Fabric Advisory Committee at Canterbury Cathedral.
Right.
I had sat on Kettle's Yard Committee for almost two decades. There are a certain number of things that I've been a member of the trustees of the Portsmouth Historic Naval Yard.
Okay.
There are a certain number of things one can do, and I find that that's already plenty. I mean, I've been a member of other parts. So perhaps more quietly, and fame is not a word that I associate with myself. So actually, however, politics could easily stir me into a bit of very vocal opposition to things that I don't like.
Right. But hasn't yet.
Your oh no, it has been there. You know, it has been there. But it's, you know, there are things that that really need adjusting, and it starts probably with a larger scale kind of urban design issues,
right?
Which a mayoral advisory panel may touch, but you know, it may be something more, a bit more focused than that, that I would be searching for.
Mm. And what are the, I mean, just kind of briefly then, the things that trouble you about London or the things that need kind of changing? I mean, what's the...
It's a well-trodden path, but it does seem to me that thinking beyond the remit or joining up better the speculator's view of what housing means and how it can be drawn into better cities and public space. So somehow a joining up of the powers that are there, you know, to be reined in some way and joined by local authorities seems to me to be, you know, a real malignant irresponsibility that's been hanging around too long. Mm. So kind of joined up urban thinking that actually leads to something other than the bottom line would be where I would be really agitated. And actually thinking about public space as more than, you know, more than the formal kind of qualities of surface and material. Spaces are defined absolutely by that which lies behind them, you know, and I don't think we do enough thinking about those kind of public, semi-public, private institutions that go to making up our public realm.
Yeah.
From politics then, returning, I guess, briefly to academia, you studied in the 1970s and then taught throughout the 80s and early 90s. Particularly, I guess, in the 1970s around the AA, was there something particular about that time?
Yeah, completely. And of course, it's down to schools of architecture and those groups of people who are leading those schools of architecture. So clearly, the period that is obviously well known now of Alvin Boyarsky's tenure at the AA was very important, as were a number of other schools. So the Polytechnic of Central London, for instance. You know, these are great centres of intense thought about what architecture might be. I think the later years of the 70s was particularly dominated by a yearning to understand better the European city and the city more generally, and the American city. So, you know, the literature is abundant and well known. But I think that was one of the unifying drives, actually, was worrying about the city. And it's very interesting to see where all those programs have led in the evolution of thinking from theory into practice over a period of 20, 30 years.
I mean, I guess people who haven't studied architecture probably don't quite understand or know that intense sort of period of very long hours in schools of architecture, an intense kind of environment for creativity and creative thinking. You were teaching undergraduate in Cambridge, were you? What was your...
I taught, interestingly, you know, talking about Cambridge then, which is very, very different to London, was another school that was spawned particularly by the AA in a way. But there were several strands to Cambridge, to be fair. But it had a very powerful period of development in the 80s and through the 90s, actually. Probably before the heavy boot of Hefke mauled it somewhat, as you've seen. I think my own trajectory there was one of learning through teaching, rather than being in the shadow of a great master. So I was given the task of running the third year by Sandy Wilson.
Right.
And I did that for probably 8 years and more. And as part of that, we ran case studies so that all the best buildings out and about being built became our prey. So that's the way students were taught about all the technical issues. Mm. Fascinating. So I had to coordinate and look through all the drawings of the great practices and came to understand the way they thought about construction and materials. And the differences are very, very noticeable. So that was one period at Cambridge. Then after that, I ran a diploma studio for a number of years.
Right.
And my aim was to actually get people to think about making, and working with the facilities of the engineering department, were able to build maybe parts of buildings, urban artifacts at a scale of 1:1. And it was a remarkable period in a way, and there are a number of people who came out of that who have continued to use that as a method of teaching.
Right. So, for people who haven't studied architecture, the studio system.
Well, at the AA, this is something that the AA spawned in a way. I think there may have been other parallels, but the rather like, you know, the French system of the Beaux-Arts, where, you know, you have somebody who's a leading light, who would gather a group of students, and they would work very closely together. So the line demarking reality in terms of practice and actually exploration and research is quite thin.
Yeah.
It moves between the two. And in that way, if you think of the figures you were probably thinking of when you think of the AA at that period, that's the way Alvin encouraged the diploma school to work. So a tutor would have a group of students from between maybe 10 to 20 maximum, and they would work together on projects over a year. So very much like a studio, an extended studio. In fact, I still see practice in that way. It's very different, but there is something of that kind of exploration. And of course, it has a lot to do with ideas, and the ideas take the form of seminars, those who come to speak about particular subjects. But the seminar table in a space like this one, which is a kind of conference room that would hold happily 20, but not happily 40 people generally, is a sort of essential part of the process of designing. You are actually stopping to think about what it is you're doing in depth. I'm describing a kind of intensity that we try and engender here as well from time to time. So if you look on our website, you'll find a number of films and recorded conversations that take place in this room, right, which might be dealing with, you know, drainage one day, but also might be dealing with the rather more, you know, kind of rarefied world of architectural philosophy.
That's a real, I think, for a lot of people who've been to university and perhaps not studied architecture, a lot of teaching is done by, you might think, an elderly professor, you know, who teaches and there are the students and the students are there to learn, and there's a very clear demarcation between professor and teacher and student. How old were you when you were teaching then? It's quite
well, actually, if I go back to the first studio, I was an assistant teacher with at the Polytechnic of Central London. I had only just finished,
right,
you know, my studies. So the difference between my age and the some of the older students was none, you know, very close.
But you're working in that collaborative studio environment.
Well, I think there is always a difference. You know, in a successful studio, there needs to be mutual respect.
Yeah.
And there is the expectation that you are going to learn. And that means a lot of homework. You know, it is when one's dealing with the history of architecture and ideas, you know, that has to be pretty sharp. You need to be able to draw a series of extremely rich veins together in order that a studio is going to work. Because if you don't have that to offer, clearly that basic trust between teacher and taught doesn't exist.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. My guest this week has been Eric Perry. You can find out more about Eric and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.